Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the show, the University of Wyoming has unveiled its proposal for steep budget cuts.
It's really tough, but it has to be done because the resources just aren't there anymore.
Businesses across Wyoming face difficult decisions when an employee tests positive for COVID-19. Many business owners are worried for their survival.
The amount of business that we lost in the season we were above would have more than paid for our month's rent.
And an expert in energy law talks about what a Biden versus Trump presidency would mean for coal.
There hasn't really been any big action by the Trump administration to revive demand for coal.
Also, a couple of stories on the election. Join us for Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Officials at the University of Wyoming have announced their draft proposal in response to a $42 million budget cut. It includes potential impacts to seven different colleges on campus, including athletics and positions, most of which are currently unfilled. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler spoke with UW Interim Provost Ann Alexander. First, Alexander lays out what's included in the draft plan.
So on the academic side, primarily what we are going to do at this time is take faculty positions that we were going to hire in the coming year that resulted from resignations or retirements, and we are just pulling those back in and making them part of the budget cut. In addition, we are going to be less able to hire new graduate students for graduate teaching assistant positions, graduate research positions, and postdoctoral and graduate administrative assistant positions. On the administrative side, that runs the gamut from athletics to finance and administration to internal audit. There will be about 35 budgeted positions that will be eliminated. Housing, dining, catering, conferences will be reorganized within the administrative side. Athletics has lowered salaries. So that's where we're at really right now.
The proposal lists a couple of degrees or programs that could be cut. Could you explain a little bit about what went into that decision making? Like, for instance, I know some people could be upset about the MFA program and creative writing getting cut.
So I will quickly summarize that they have not been cut at this time. They are up for a review. And so we're doing a number of different kinds of reviews in the coming months. One is called a University Regulation 213 review, which is our regulation that governs reorganization, consolidations, discontinuances of academic programs. That process is what kicked off this week. It's not that we have said the MFA is gone as of today. What we are saying is we are going to have the MFA and all of the other things that are in that list undergo a review that will last up to 120 days. And at the end of January, that process will conclude internally on campus, where a review process will go into all of the details of not just the numbers, but also the strategic strengths and weaknesses and opportunities of each of those programs and each of those proposals. And then we will make a recommendation to the trustees in their February meeting as to whether any of those programs should be eliminated or consolidated or reorganized. The particular list for that type of review was pulled together based on recommendations from the various colleges around low enrollment programs, programs that are not well used, or programs where the faculty sustainability was not there.
And so when formulating these reductions, was there any kind of consistent theme or like running idea that you had when thinking about what to cut?
Well, I think the theme that continuously comes up is that we need to find a way to, first of all, because the biggest lever that we could pull was taking all of those empty faculty positions. That is a terribly non-strategic thing to do, but is the only thing that we have at the moment. But what we heard consistently was that we need to be, we can't just do this and then like sit back and go, okay, well, that's done. First of all, we know there are probably more cuts coming. But secondly, we have consistently over the past several years in taking the previous budget cuts have been fairly non-strategic at those times as well. And so what that has led to is a very shallow departments around the academic enterprise where there are only one or two people that are specialists in a given area. And it just puts a lot of strain on our staff and on our faculty.
Yeah. And in the same vein, when formulating these cuts, are they for the long term? Are these things that can come back?
We're not going to get this money back from the state. So we have smaller number of resources. We can't do the same thing with less. We can't do more with less. We can't do less. We can't do the same thing with less. We have to do less with less. So this is kind of just the first wave of programs that were identified. There may be others that will be identified later, probably by March. That's why we need to be more strategic and look at ways of expanding our own revenue sources, grant funding, donor funding, corporate partnerships, those kinds of things, just primarily because the state has been incredibly generous with us. And this cut is not because they do not wish to have a strong university, but simply because the state's revenues are also down.
So you mentioned the likelihood of further cuts coming. Do we have a number or what that could potentially look like?
Yeah, so I don't know what the amount will be. We haven't gotten a bill, but it's been rather clearly telegraphed to us that it's likely that we will have to have another cut because the state just doesn't have the money. So the magnitude, I don't know, but I will say there's no fat left. And so at this next stage, what we are going to have to do is look to those academic programs, which is part of why we need to start that process as soon as possible so that we can start identifying the programs that we cannot sustain, that we cannot do anymore. It's going to come down to that because most of the money in a university's budget is in people. Next time we can't, there's not much else to look at for cost cutting. So it will have to be more on the academic side. So that will mean fewer classes. It will mean fewer student services. It will mean that we will have to eliminate programs.
So the proposal is due to the Board of Trustees on November 1st, and then they'll discuss it at a later November meeting. Then, if approved, will that kick off this review?
They will say, okay, your plan for managing the cuts that we are currently having to manage through just basically right now, they will say, okay, we like this plan. The plan is good. Go ahead. And they will also pull out whether or not those particular programs should be reviewed, whether there are more, whether there are different ones. But our proposal, we hope, is something that they will take into their counsel and make a decision from there. This is not easy. This is tough. And it's incredibly tough during a pandemic to do this. I know everybody's been working so hard at the university for so long. The past 7 months have been just, a full on complete effort, people just giving their all. And so it's really tough to follow all that great work up with this. It's really tough, but it has to be done because the resources just aren't there anymore.
Anne Alexander is the Interim Provost and Vice President of Academic Affairs at the University of Wyoming. Thanks, Anne, for taking the time.
Well, thank you, Catherine. It was great to talk to you.
When we come back, more on business impacts and COVID-19, plus more CARES Act money is available. This is Open Spaces.
This time on the Modern West, the super wealthy are moving into rural America with grand plans to help small towns. But it doesn't always pan out.
He bought up all those buildings on Main Street and boarded them up, and he's killing the town.
A Stranger Comes to Town, part 3 of the Ghost Towning series. Find the Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming, like many states, has tried to strike a balance between letting businesses operate and slowing the spread of COVID-19. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor reports businesses are struggling to keep their doors open amid a rapid rise in coronavirus cases.
The Crowbar and Grill in downtown Laramie had to radically alter its business when COVID-19 hit Wyoming in March. Health orders from the state forced it and other businesses to halt in-person dining. When they were allowed to reopen, new health recommendations meant a closed bar and socially distanced tables.
We've worked really, really hard to follow all of the guidelines.
That's Emily Madden, a general manager at Crowbar.
Dining in restaurants has an inherent risk for both customers and employees. I mean, employees are in that building all day long while customers come in and can take their masks off to eat. So it's really important to us to make sure that everyone stays as safe as possible.
But no one can be 100% safe. As the coronavirus continues to surge across Wyoming, several businesses throughout the state have chosen to close down for days or weeks after an employee tested positive. At Crowbar, that happened earlier this month, but it didn't come as a shock to Madden.
Watching the numbers in Albany County increase daily, like, we knew it was just a matter of time before we had a positive case at work. Statistically, it was going to happen. It was a matter of when and not if.
The restaurant shut down for 5 days as other employees waited for the results of their own COVID tests. It's a familiar story playing out in communities across Wyoming. In Cody, things initially looked good for Sunlight Sports. Co-owner Wes Allen says that's because of the type of store they are.
We're an outdoor store, and a lot of people went out camping this summer. So, you know, we were fortunate to be busy since we reopened in May. And we've been busy because people have been camping.
But then the store had to close for a few days after one employee was presumed positive. Allen says staying closed for several days isn't easy for a local business.
There's definitely an impact, right? The amount of business that we lost and the taste that we were buzzed would have more than paid for our month's rent. And, you know, we have staff that lose income.
With the virus spreading so rapidly and winter in the headlights, there's no guarantee it won't happen again.
The impact was minimal this time. We were being very careful so that we didn't have an outbreak on staff that would shut us down for 2 weeks, which would have a pretty devastating impact on the business during this time of year.
Less than a block from Sunlight, Cody's Irma Hotel and Restaurant experienced its own business halting brush with COVID. Mike Darby co-owns the Irma with his brother. He says the restaurant had to shut down after two employees tested positive.
Trying to do the prudent thing, we arranged for a testing for anybody in the building. And speaking of employees that want to get tested, we had 27 tests, and we had 7 positives come back.
Finding so many positives, Darby says the rest of the staff was tested, and the second round turned up even more cases.
Prior to the second testing, you know, as soon as the positives started coming in, we closed our business. We did. Just thought it was the wise thing to do for public safety and for the safety of our employees.
The restaurant stayed closed for more than a week. And Darby says the Irma paid its employees through the time they couldn't work. That's a significant financial hit right at the end of tourist season. But Darby says the truly scary thing about finding so many positives is that almost no one got seriously sick. The majority of those positive cases ended up being asymptomatic.
I mean, there's so many asymptomatic people walking the streets, and they have no reason to think they're sick. And most of them don't even realize that they're infected, so they're going to go talk to people who become infected, and on it goes.
Both Darby and Allen say the Park County Public Health Department was helpful and communicative throughout their ordeals. That's not the case in Albany County, where Madden and others wish there was more guidance coming from public health officials.
There's no template for what we're supposed to be doing if somebody does test positive. There's no guidance from the state. There's no financial support for businesses that have to close down.
That puts retail and restaurant businesses in a tight spot when an employee tests positive. Making the decision to close and keep employees safe means turning away customers at a time when customers are hard to come by and harder to accommodate. Crowbar Management made what it considers the ethical choice to close. As the coronavirus surges, especially in Laramie, Madden worries about the next time someone gets sick.
It's inevitable that it happens again. And when it happens again, we financially cannot close down every single time it happens. The business won't survive if we have to close down constantly.
Madden says government action and communication could make those hard decisions easier and better informed. It could also level the playing field between businesses acting responsibly and those currently acting more recklessly.
Why do we work so hard to do the right things when there's other businesses in this city that haven't followed the rules at all, have had multiple positive cases, have had no one telling them they have to close down? Why would anybody try at that point?
Crowbar is now open again. Madden is hoping it can stay that way. For Wyoming Public Radio, this is Jeff Victor.
This week, Governor Mark Gordon unveiled some final CARES Act aid. The money will be split between Wyoming businesses and the agriculture community. The Wyoming Business Council will oversee the distribution, and Wyoming Business Council CEO Josh Durrell joins me to explain the funding, starting with the agriculture support.
So this latest round of CARES Act funding will be focused primarily on those agriculture producers who are, you know, protein crops or fiber that have incurred losses due to COVID. About $90 million have been allotted, which is it's a fantastic amount. I think it's going to make a big difference for our agricultural producers across the state. So we're really excited about helping them out.
That one, I mean, what's your expectation? What's out there? What kinds of things have people been struggling with?
Yeah, you know, the prices in the markets have been challenging. Those folks that, maybe at one point they would have normally had really good prices, or their business operation was running in a certain way and everything was fine. And then just with the disruptions in the supply chain, that has changed pretty dramatically and really quickly for those producers out there. And so that's really what we're trying to step in and help, is just to cover those losses that supply chains and processing and a lot of challenges throughout the agricultural industry this year.
Now, one of the things I know was talked quite a bit about at the start of the pandemic was getting some CARES Act money, not only to businesses, but nonprofits as well. This next round, I understand this is what people can do with this.
Yeah, absolutely. So the agricultural fund with that $90 million is one thing that's opening up on November 2nd. But another one is a business relief program, the fourth of which will take the remainder of the money that we had from the other programs. Right now, it's about $23 million. And it will make that available on the 2nd as well. And you're right, it's not only businesses, but it's nonprofits as well. So C3s, C6s, C12s, and C19s will all be able to take advantage of this. There are no restrictions on the number of employees. The only restriction for nonprofits is that they must do less than 50% of their operation needs to go toward lobbying. So any lobbying groups that are primarily focused on that are not eligible.
Now, so if I'm a business, what do I need to prove to you to get some of this money?
Yeah, so you'll need to prove that you've had the latest program, you'll need to show that you've had revenue loss and impact due to COVID. And so what we're doing is we're comparing last year's revenue to this year's revenue through this period of time, and show that you've had a loss and be able to really direct that toward COVID. Which many businesses don't have a problem doing that at all, right? Everything has been impacted dramatically due to COVID this year. Being able to prove that loss and show your numbers from last year and this year is the key. You'll also need to show any other funding that you've received, either from the CARES Act funding that we've been a part of, or any PPP and other programs that the federal government has brought out due to COVID, and so that you can subtract that off.
Talking just a little bit about what you'd hope some of these people would do. Obviously, there's some that just need to probably survive and kind of move. But do you also want them to maybe look at how they can move forward using some of this money?
Absolutely, Bob. And that's a key component that we're starting to see, and not just starting, but businesses across the state have done a really good job of not just surviving, but figuring out new ways to serve customers. You know, whether that's the restaurant that really amped up their curbside, or maybe it's the shop that didn't do much sales online and then found a way to put their product line out online and be able to take internet orders. You know, we've been seeing a lot of examples of businesses really just finding new ways to serve their customers. And what we're hoping and what we're really excited about is that in the future, they'll be able to have things come back to normal, but now have a new portion of their business that'll make them even more successful.
Josh Durrell, director of the Wyoming Business Council, visiting with us. So I think that something very important that people need to hear right now is there is a tight time frame for applying for these things.
That's absolutely true. This fund, because both of these funds, the agriculture and what we're calling the endurance fund focused on businesses, both of these funds have a pretty short window, and that's from November 2nd at 10 a.m. until November 18th at 8 p.m., those times again are November 2nd through November 18th. And the challenge is that we have to have all of this wrapped up by December 30th. And so that means taking these applications in, going through and vetting them and working through the application process, then pushing them on to the Secretary of State's office as well as the state auditor's office for payment. All of that does take time, and we have the federal government has given us a hard deadline right now of December 30th. To get these funds out the door.
People can learn more about this and how to apply through some informational webinars you've got going on. Where can people find out about those?
Yeah, so the website that you should all go to is yobizrelief.org. That's yobizrelief.org. There's a frequently asked questions as well as a worksheet to figure out your grant amount. All of that is available on that yobizrelief.org website.
Again, if people are interested in these CARES Act dollars that are available and just through a very short time up until November 18th, you can go to the website yobizrelief.org for more information. Josh, thank you so much. Josh Durrell, he's the director of the Wyoming Business Council.
My pleasure, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we will feature a pair of election stories. This is Open Spaces.
This time on the Kids Ask Why podcast, we go on an adventure with the mountain man John Coulter.
He was trapping there with a trapper by the name of Potts. And the two men were going down the river in their canoe collecting their traps.
And learn all about beavers, the animal mountain men trapped almost to extinction.
When they find a mate, they usually keep that mate for life.
Find Kids Ask Why under podcast at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The Wind River Reservation has long faced unique barriers to voting. This year, the coronavirus pandemic is adding more. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports.
Last weekend, as the Wind River Reservation was bracing for snow, Wyoming State Representative Andy Clifford was squeezing in some roadside campaigning in Arapaho. Clifford, a citizen of the Northern Arapaho Tribe, is running for re-election against Republican Valera Whiteman and Independent Clint Wagon. Because of the pandemic, she and her team have been spending a lot of time outside in the cold.
We think of our ancestors and what they've gone through, you know, under the elements and stuff, so it's a little bit of suffering for a couple of hours, but I don't care.
Two women pull up in a pickup. Campaign volunteer Cherie LeBeau brings them bowls of stew and fry bread.
What do you want to drink? Dr. Pepper, Pepsi, water?
And Representative Clifford hands them a voting guide.
So did you get to vote yet?
Not yet.
Okay. You can go early.
Oh, the Lander Courthouse, 450 North 2nd.
But a week before Election Day, Clifford's constituents had cast about a third as many early and mail-in ballots as voters in the neighboring House district. That majority white district contains the city of Lander and the only early voting center in Fremont County. Depending on where you live on Wind River and what the weather's like, that drive to vote early in Lander can take anywhere from 25 minutes to an hour.
However, I'm encouraging people to go because the coronavirus is at a spike here, and I don't want them to be quarantined and not be able to go and vote on November 3rd.
And Wind River is far from the only reservation facing compounding barriers to voting this year.
It's just layered obstacle on top of obstacle on top of obstacle.
Samantha Kelty is an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund, or NARF. She says strict voter registration laws disproportionately impact Natives in some places. Poor postal access on reservations makes voting by mail a challenge. And then there's what NARF calls the tyranny of distance, a problem that's made worse by the pandemic.
It's caused worsening economic conditions or loss of jobs. And so when it was hard enough to find enough money for a tank of gas to get to the county seat, now it's just impossible.
That's why NARF worked to secure satellite voting offices on reservations across Montana this year, where many Native people would otherwise travel 2 to 3 times farther than non-Natives to get to the polls. NARF also helped secure the right of third-party organizations to collect ballots and deliver them to election officials on behalf of tribal members in Montana. Marcy McLean, a citizen of the Blackfeet Nation, heads up one of those organizations called Western Native Voice. She says third-party ballot collection in those satellite offices have been key during the pandemic.
The way the virus is taking over in our communities, I hope people are being safe. And I think one of those precautions should be staying home and not going to an election office, especially when it's outside of our tribal nation.
There have never been early voting centers on the Wind River Reservation. But in past years, there has been one in Riverton, which has a larger and more diverse population than Lander and is a shorter drive from some parts of the reservation. This year, Fremont County Clerk Julie Freese says she doesn't have the staff to open the Riverton office.
With the increase in absentee balloting, it's taking a lot more of my people time here.
Plus, the pandemic has driven a lot of land sales, vehicle sales.
We're doing a lot of comp time in this office, just trying to keep up.
For now, Freese says her hands are tied by state staffing and security requirements for satellite election offices.
Can those be changed by legislation? Yeah, maybe. I think we can look at some of those that have come up through COVID, but I don't see any way I can do early voting on the reservation at this time.
Meanwhile, community spread of COVID-19 has reached an all-time high on the Wind River Reservation. According to Dr. Paul Ebert of the Northern Arapaho Tribes Clinic, as many as 300 tribal members could be under quarantine orders on Election Day. He says the best way for those people to cast their ballots is to call the Fremont County Clerk's office and arrange to vote curbside. To her constituents who are afraid of contracting the virus at the polls, Representative Clifford says there's one more opportunity to make that drive to Lander.
Go vote early. Vote now, just in case you do come down with the virus. And, you know, we're all about protecting our elders, protecting our people, family, and friends with underlying health conditions. And so it's going to be very crucial.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr.
Joe Biden's stance on fracking has been all over the news, that the Democratic presidential candidate would prohibit the practice on federal land while allowing current permits to continue. Well, the presidential election is also expected to impact U.S. coal markets, either way it breaks. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaks with Caitlin McCoy about what that might look like. McCoy is a staff attorney at the Harvard Law School's Environmental and Energy Law Program.
It's almost hard to describe what, you know, the potential impact of a Biden administration is without the contrast, I think, of a potential Trump administration. I don't want to sound insensitive because I know that people's jobs and livelihoods are at stake. And it's really easy for people who don't live in communities that currently depend on coal mining to just say, for the sake of climate, we have to stop using coal. And that said, the writing is on the wall, and it has been for a while now. And the market forces that we've seen at play under the Trump administration have been really powerful, despite what the Trump administration has done to try to preserve demand for coal. So I really think the big difference in a potential Biden administration and a second term Trump administration comes in the sort of sense that I think Trump would essentially leave the industry to just kind of wither on its own, which is somewhat what he's done over the last 4 years. Yes, there have been actions that have lowered compliance costs and loosened requirements a little bit, but there hasn't really been any big action by the Trump administration to revive demand for coal or to actively support coal mining. And so I think really the big difference is that a Biden administration will seek to, as Biden has said, accelerate the transition away from coal. But I think the sort of complementary piece of that is I think a potential Biden administration will also be creating programs to retrain workers in the industry and work to provide for an economic transition. And I don't think workers can rely on the Trump administration if there is a second term to provide programs like that, that I think the industry will just be left to the mercy of the markets and will hear President Trump doggedly repeating the same lines, you know, that he's saved coal. But the reality on the ground is very different. And I think people have experienced that over the last 4 years.
So there are some specific policies as well that could go beyond the secular decline that you're talking about with a Biden presidency that would accelerate it. Climate-related proposals, other promises related to renewables. Could you talk a little bit about those?
A potential Biden administration would theoretically enact the plans that Vice President Biden has released. And those plans call for a carbon-free electricity system by 2035. And so, yes, that certainly would be the type of plan that would increase pressure on utilities to phase out coal for energy generation here in the United States. And that, I think, would be a big part of changing demand for coal in this country.
Anything else to mention regarding coal or energy before we sign off here?
Well, I would say that President Trump has worked to make energy this keystone issue, you know, as part of his first campaign and his first term. Energy was this really key issue that he kept coming back to. But I think that when we look closely at President Trump's record, especially on coal mining, we don't really see him delivering on proposals that actively support mining and help revive the demand for coal. He's loosened some requirements, but I think if you take a close look beyond some of the statements that he makes and look at whether he's really made a difference for the industry, we've seen more closure of coal capacity in the United States during President Trump's first term than under Obama's second term. And the reality is it's just hard to outrun the market forces.
That was Harvard's Caitlin McCoy on the election's potential impacts on coal production. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
On Tuesday, Wyoming will vote to send two women to Congress. Former Republican Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis is running against UW Professor Mirav Ben-David for the U.S. Senate seat. The two differ on almost everything, especially when it comes to health care, climate change, and the future of Wyoming's economy. On the House side, two-term U.S. Representative Liz Cheney is facing off against Democrat Lynette Grable, who is the first known Native American to seek a Wyoming congressional seat. Grable has enjoyed her time in the limelight to target some key issues.
Yes, it gives me the opportunity to push out issues that I feel like a lot of people who live in disadvantaged or even poor communities face.
Lynette Grable has devoted her career to dealing with issues ranging from poverty to building communities, and lately missing and murdered Indigenous women. In fact, during a recent debate, she chided Liz Cheney for opposing the Violence Against Women Act, which led to a post-debate discussion between the two. Liz Cheney currently ranks third in House Republican leadership. She's used the campaign to tell Wyoming businesses that she's planning on supporting more COVID-19 aid, but sometimes it's harder than it looks.
We need to make sure we're providing, you know, continued resources, but they need to be targeted. They need to be responsible. We need to make sure that we're not
just going down the path of agreeing to what we've seen Speaker Pelosi and the House Democrats try to pass, which includes a lot of funding that's completely unrelated to COVID.
Cheney says that includes efforts that range from supporting the Kennedy Center to impacting voting. She says Wyoming has received millions in federal aid, but she also understands the concern and frustration many continue to feel. Grable remembers working hard to help people during the major recession that recently occurred and favors a targeted plan that doesn't just provide aid.
Now, also looking at our unemployment, how can we stop our unemployment rate from continuing to rise? How do we look at, you know, ensuring that American people are not being not only evicted, but possibly losing their mortgages yet again? And then also food security.
On the topic of health care, both Cheney and Grable know that the Affordable Care Act will be back on the table after the election, especially since the future of the ACA could be decided by the courts. For Cheney, her first priority would be to keep the country from moving to a Medicare for All model. She also stresses that she and other Republicans are supporters of protecting those with pre-existing conditions. Since the ACA reforms have not gone far, Cheney has tried approaches by getting legislation passed to expand telehealth.
Make sure that people can get access to their doctors, recognizing that in many, many instances, you know, on top of the long distances and the challenges with weather and everything else that people across the state face, now you've got COVID in the mix. And so making sure people can continue to see their physicians and to do it, you know, through telehealth.
Cheney says addressing drug pricing, overall price transparency, and access to COVID treatments are a focus of hers. Grable says she's nervous about those plans to shift away from the Affordable Care Act into something else, mainly because of the pre-existing condition issue. But she says the cost of the insurance is the number one complaint she hears. She says she hears stories of some who got subsidies that got taken away. In fact, this happened to a friend of hers.
From like $200 and something to $600 and something. And even though she got a raise, she didn't make enough money to afford insurance on her own because that was, if she got it on her own, it would be $800.
Grable says the focus should be on making the Affordable Care Act actually affordable. Grable and Cheney say there is a lot to do in this area, but it might be that they'll have to focus on small solutions. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck. When we come back, a discussion with the new director of the Wyoming Department of Corrections. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Governor Mark Gordon has announced the new director of the Wyoming Department of Corrections. Dan Shannon has been with the department since 2007 and previously served as the deputy director. Shannon, who's been in corrections for more than 20 years, says reorganization of the department due to budget cuts is his main focus. He spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler about how the department will be adapting to working with less.
Congratulations on the new position.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Could you first explain a little bit about how the department was affected by this first round of budget cuts?
Well, the department's affected in a number of ways. First and foremost, we have to remain fiscally responsible and get things in line and live within our means. But it's also a balancing act where we don't step to the other side where we're jeopardizing safety. We've cut $1 million of operational costs out of three smaller facilities and $1.5 million out of our larger facilities. We had 162 positions that were removed from our budget. 82 of those were unfunded, but it also included 14 individuals here from central office that lost employment.
And are you anticipating any further cuts?
I would anticipate, yes, that we will have additional cuts. We're going to be a much leaner corrections than we were in the past. Director Lampert clearly put us on a pathway to have a solid foundation for a department, but things have changed with COVID and as well as our budget. We have to also, to be able to produce an excellent product, we're responsible to ensure that when individuals return to our communities that they're going back in a lot better way than when they came to us. So we're going to have to function differently. We no longer can look at our department the way we did just even up to a year or 2 years ago. And I'll give you some examples. The way we're housing our inmates, the locations. I returned the inmates back from Mississippi. We also had our female offenders in Scotts Bluff. We had 34 of those we returned. And also individuals were housed in county jails. We don't really have a inmate populace issue. They just need to be reassigned in the way we house them. Now, we have staffing issues at our Wyoming State Penitentiary in Rawlins, which I'm going to work on next to address. So fundamentally, it'll look much different than it did even a year ago, that being the department itself.
You know, and in mentioning about reorganizing the populations, I mean, I think the state has been talking for a while about how facilities are overwhelmed by the numbers. Is this not the case, or do you think we just have to reorganize to use the space we have more effectively?
We have our boot camp that I asked the judiciary to, on an interim topic, to change the way we present it to be a more cognitive-based program, which has been moving forward, and I'll follow it through the legislative session. That's a 64-bed facility at Newcastle that never has more than 13, 14 individuals in it. I'm going to reassign that to our penitentiary, and then I will have our females, which we were going to build a new building, reassign that program. We'll create our female facility to our women's center. Now, with that being said, our ladies who are attending our intensive treatment program have always had a backlog. We're going to reassign that to Newcastle. It'll provide 64 beds and also free up the amount of space, 50 beds, at our facility. We have vacancies in our minimum facility in Riverton, and I will reassign the individuals from Newcastle to Riverton, thereby freeing up space for our penitentiary. So it really is a matter of restructuring the way we look at corrections and the way we have to conscientiously and objectively house them according to their classification. We're not going to put any person or community at risk. But we do have vacancies we just haven't really weren't necessary to take advantage of in the past.
And beyond budget challenges, what are the other biggest challenges you think the department is currently facing?
My number one focus, excluding the budget right now, is COVID. We were fortunate. We took some very drastic steps. I would use that term because there's nothing more important than interaction and family visits, things of that nature. We canceled all that in March. We found alternative ways. We are following CDC guidelines. That's changing constantly. Just in July, we had in excess of 100 individuals positive. Right now, we're down to about 5 or 6. We're doing some working with the Department of Health. We're doing wastewater treatment. At that point, in July, we were doing mandatory testing of all staff and inmates. Now we're doing 20% sampling. My focus right now, because it's a very serious situation, and we're the same as a community. I mean, we're all living together there. We function as a community. It doesn't matter if a person is going to an educational service or a person has medical, such as dialysis treatments necessary. We perform that inside our facilities. And COVID as well. I mean, when COVID gets inside, it's extremely dangerous. And just the same as we see the growth across our state, that's what's really keeping me up at night at this point.
Dan Shannon is the new director of the Wyoming Department of Corrections. Thank you, Dan, for taking the time to speak with me.
Yeah, thank you for your time.
Now moving to education. Northwest College President Stephanie Hickswaugh will be leaving to become the new chancellor at Montana State University Billings. Hickswaugh was president of the community college in Powell for 7 years. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelskis spoke with her about her biggest accomplishments as president.
I'm really, really thrilled and proud to report that in the years that I've been here and the work that faculty and staff have done, we successfully implemented numerous student success initiatives. And in 2018 and 2019, we had the highest graduation rates in the history of the college, and we had the highest fall-to-fall retention rate in a 16-year history of the college. That retention rate is one of the best in the state. And so I'm just really proud of the way that the faculty and staff have embraced student success. And, you know, they just have this superpower of reaching out to students and engaging students and making it easier for them to pursue their goals. And so I'm so very proud.
Yeah, so it sounds like that's one of your biggest accomplishments when you look back.
It really is what I'm most proud of, because it has directly impacted student success. I mean, we can see them graduating in higher numbers and being able to transfer and pursue their degree or go right into the workforce.
Could you talk about some challenges you faced?
Certainly, the budget cuts have been really, really impactful. We're not able to offer all of the curriculum that we did 7 years ago when I first came, and there are human beings that are no longer working at the college that contributed a great deal, and it's been devastating, quite frankly, for the college to lose those people who were serving students and really doing a good job. And so that's certainly been a huge challenge, and it will continue to be a challenge for the college as we look at the state budget situation. But I'm hopeful going forward. We engaged in a process with a company called Campus Works to look at ways that we can be more innovative and deliver education programming and not have to rely so much on state appropriations. So I think in the coming years, we're going to see some transitions at the college that will help that budget situation be able to move forward. So I'm hopeful for that as we look to the future of the college.
You are accepting the chancellor position at Montana State University Billings, which isn't that far away from Northwest College. It seems like there could be possibilities for partnerships. As you go into your new position, are you thinking about things like that?
Yes. The short answer is yes. With my background in community college leadership, I think there's some incredible opportunities to partner for transfer. But last fall, we started working with MSUB on some partnerships beyond just transfer. We looked at the curricula at both the university and Northwest College, and there's some things that we can do to share some faculty resources and share curricula that could help both institutions. So that's really exciting. We also just last year put a partnership together for transfer from our nursing program. So we have an associate's degree in nursing. Montana State University in Billings has an RN program. So RN to BSN program MOU has already been put together. We just need to launch it. It was paused because of COVID. So that's something we can launch right away. And I think that there are similar opportunities to work with Sheridan College because of its proximity to Billings as well. So while I will be leaving to take a new position, I am not going to be a stranger to Northwest College. I think there's lots of opportunities.
Well, Northwest College President Stephanie Hickswell, thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. Archived editions of this show can be found at wyomingpublicmedia.org. And don't forget to sign up for our podcast. Individual segments can be found on that site and on Facebook. Anna Rader is our web editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.